From Seattle, this is World Trade Watch on day two of the WTO summit. On today's program,
police are out in force, tear gas is in the air, as thousands of protesters march through the city.
We'll look at some of the issues that have activists in the streets, including corporate control of agriculture.
And we'll hear from third world trade ministers and a WTO opponent in the U.S. Congress and grassroots activists.
With Norman Solomon, I'm Julie Light. All this coming up on World Trade Watch. First, these headlines.
With headlines from the World Trade Organization Summit in Seattle, I'm Philip Babbage. A historic confrontation over the global policies of the World Trade Organization got under warning as tens of thousands of activists launched a pivotal day of protest in the streets of Seattle. While top officials from the 130 countries of the WTO began their first full day of summit meetings, protesters from around the world were moving into the streets, with signs, banners, and puppets challenging the WTO as an anti-democratic tool of corporate power. Occurring amidst a very large and heavily equipped police presence in downtown Seattle, today's stepped-up protest actions come after several days of forums, teach-ins, and preliminary demonstrations. Meanwhile, Clinton administration spokespeople in Seattle, including Commerce Secretary William Daley and Agriculture Secretary Dan Glickman, made the rounds speaking to representatives of non-governmental organizations. The cabinet officials portrayed the World Trade Organization as a vital institution that helps countries to raise their standard of living. And the officials argued that backing for the WTO is consistent with support for labor standards, environmental protection, and human rights. It's a theme that President Clinton is expected to emphasize after he arrives in Seattle early Wednesday. Some news reports say that Clinton was the highly visible street protests as leverage for pushing the WTO to embrace labor and environmental standards. But the anti-WTO activists here in Seattle insist that with friends like Clinton, they don't need any enemies. Yesterday, activists of all ages, including labor union members, farmers, and environmentalists, gathered outside a McDonald's restaurant in downtown Seattle to express their opposition to the corporatization of food. An activist from Madison, Wisconsin, Jeff Peck, explained that all the corporate sponsorship of these WTO meetings was, for him, a symbol of how democracy is being left out of the process.
Well, that's one way you could look at sort of the McDonaldization of the world. And yeah, you definitely sense that here when you look at like who sponsored the WTO, you know, welcoming committees, all these corporations put money into it. And I guess the whole idea here is to sure show that, you know, democracy has been left out and people are here to express themselves.
Family farmer Mary Lippert of Wanakee, Wisconsin, was there too. She said that all the different issues being brought up this week in connection with the WTO relate directly to family farm issues.
All over the world, it's all the same. It's the health issues, it's the biotechnology issues. In Wisconsin, all over the United States these days, almost all farmers are planting genetically engineered foods, basically biotech, with no choice, no alternative. Many of them don't even know there is an alternative. They think that is the answer to all their problems. And then it's forced on the consumer, and the consumer has no idea. So it's almost every issue, environmental issues, everything comes together for the family farmer like everyone else.
A conference hosted by the People's Assembly, a coalition of Filipino human rights groups, offered its critique of the World Trade Organization's impact on agriculture, women, and people of the northern and southern hemispheres. According to Lisa Maza, Secretary General of the Gabriela Network, the conditions for women working on farms and in factories forced some of them to make desperate choices.
Some women, and an increasing number of them, including children, have to sell even their bodies to prostitute themselves. The Philippines right now has 600,000 prostitutes, which is the highest in Southeast Asia. And this is the result of the economic policies that only cause poverty.
The Filipina leader says the People's Assembly contends that the junking of the WTO is the only solution.
There's no such thing as free trade. There's no such thing as fair trade. There's no such thing as level playing field. These are all myths.
Officials from China are expected to lobby European Union delegates to support that country's entry into the WTO. In recent weeks, China has signed trade deals with Canada and the United States. Advocates for China's acceptance in the WTO say that open markets will lead to more democracy in that country. But Wei Jingsheng, a Chinese dissident in exile, said on Monday in Seattle that the promise of democracy through trade is suspect.
I think that the most crucial thing for people within China is that the WTO is concerned with is the equality of trade. And what everyone is most concerned with is whether or not entering the WTO can actually ensure free trade within China. A lot of people now have that hope, but whether or not that can be accomplished is another thing altogether.
There are also concerns that opening China's markets could lead to heavy job losses. With news headlines from Seattle, I'm Philip Babbage.
Joining us now in studio here in Seattle is Deborah Toler, a specialist in global political economy, who's an analyst for these World Trade Watch broadcasts this week. Well, Deborah, there's tear gas in the air around the convention center downtown, and there's also a show of automatic weapons from very heavily armed police forces in the city. People are going up against a lot, have come from around the country and the world. Why this level of tension, energy, and confrontation? What are the underlying factors that strike you this morning?
Well, my first reaction is that initially I was saying this is an overreaction, you know, and I just couldn't understand the overreaction. But if we really think about it, this is a culmination. We're at the end of the century. We're talking about one of the most critically, if not the most critically important issue to masses of people in terms of, I'm actually going to use a word we don't talk about too much anymore, capitalism. And people have become, the protesters and activists here have a very clear analysis of what is at stake at these meetings. So they come with a strong analysis and with the emotional import that one would expect when we're talking about livelihoods and livelihood of the future when we talk about the environment. So that accounts for the energy and the determination on one side. And then we have the other side, which is basically transnational capital, which is equally determined that the people are not going to win this one. And that's what we see being fought out right now in the streets.
Well, grassroots activists, of course, are very, very conscious of what they feel is at stake in this battle. Define what is at stake for the people on the other side of the barricades. What are they concerned about gaining or losing?
You mean on the WTO side? They are very concerned about losing the what they've built up over particularly the last 20 years, I would say, under this whole neoliberal structure. They have very carefully and very successfully managed to make it so that transnational corporations and financial institutions that engage in currency speculation, et cetera, have been able to run amok, basically. And now, all of a sudden, it seems that the stop could be put on that, a curb could be put on that. And that is absolutely unacceptable as far as they're concerned. And the fact that they're getting it from so many different sides is what makes it very difficult for them to be able to deal with.
Deborah, we're getting reports from our correspondents in the field who are at the convention center as we speak that there are armored personnel carriers, automatic weapons. Certainly in the last day or two, the police have been out in force, heavily armed. With the eyes of the world on the WTO, how do you think that this is going to play with citizens around the world?
You know, it's very interesting. One would think that you're almost tempted to think there's a plot afoot to make the story of these meetings be the confrontation and a plot afoot to force the demonstrators, who I'm going to tell you firsthand have been totally organized, determined to keep this peaceful, determined that they wanted their message to get through about what their complaints are. If it turns into a violent confrontation, of course, that message doesn't get through. The whole story is about the demonstrators. And so I can't help but wonder if there's something in the works, acknowledged or not, that's what they want the story to be. In that way, you know, the WTO, which we know operates secretly, can go back to Geneva and proceed, even if the summit ends up, you know, in tatters, and proceed with what they want to do. And the eyes of the world will say, oh, you know, what was wrong with those people? I don't think it's going to succeed. The people who are here have been too smart to allow that to happen. They have brilliantly planned the demonstrations with banners that carry the message, with costumes that carry the message. They've been very effective in the media. I've noticed a change in the local media Last night, I actually heard local media say peaceful demonstrations about, you know, concerned about sea turtles. And that was the first time I'd actually heard the local media give, a fair and balanced presentation of what was at stake, as opposed to saying these people are trying to stop free trade.
This is really in some ways, a watershed for this international coalition that is coming together from all over the world on a variety of issues. You've been spending a lot of time, particularly with the African delegation. Can you give us a sense of what the strengths are in this international coalition and whether you think it will hold together beyond sea?
The strengths, to put it simply, are the clarity that everyone has here that the way the World Trade Organization functions is unacceptable for human beings, for the environment. They are all clear on that, and that doesn't matter if if they're from North-South groups. It doesn't matter if they're environmentalists, if they're labor, if they're farmers. They're all very clear on that, and that is the ultimate strength that underlies. After that, you will get into, and this is something groups are discussing. It's one of the beauties of this whole process is that you see this dialogue going on. There are differences between some of the organizations that are from Africa, Asia, and Latin America, and the North. The industrialized countries naturally have a different set of standards and issues than are from the South. So there are some differences within those. There are differences within some of the groups. Some of the farmer groups, for example, that are more concerned with lowering tariffs versus those that are more concerned with environmental and organically produced crops. Definitely differences within labor. So there are differences. So what people are doing today, the demonstrations today, are about the focus on the points of unity. In the workshops and teach-ins, we get into how are we going to resolve some of the differences and different approaches. There are people who are arguing the WTO ought to be abolished. There are others that think reforms are interesting, et cetera.
On that note, the diversity of approaches in terms of what should or shouldn't be done with the WTO seems to be at least metaphorically represented by the approach today, quite literally in the streets, where tens of thousands of people are marching, largely with some union organizing like the Machinists and the AFL-CIO, to say we want our voices heard with the WTO, we want it transformed, and they're marching through the streets. There are other folks who say we're going to shut it down today. We want to shut down the WTO summit, and that perhaps parallels the notion that this trade organization should not be saved. It's not worth trying to salvage.
That is absolutely the case. I know within the AFL-CIO, the leadership, the hierarchy of the organization, has basically taken the approach that the agreements need to be reformed and need to include more labor rights and labor protections like the right to form unions and et cetera. But there are other member unions and rank-and-file members who believe that the World Trade Organization and the agreements just need to be completely ditched. And so you see that just within the United States labor movement, and you certainly see that with the issues. I think more the South labor unions believe the WTO needs to go. They don't believe it could ever work on their behalf very effectively.
In terms of domestic politics, and we have just a moment left or a minute left in this segment, the AFL-CIO is in this curious position in Seattle of protesting the policies of a Clinton-Gore administration that it supports.
I think many of their member unions and rank-and-file members believe that they really put themselves in an impossible position. They endorsed Gore very early into the presidential campaign, and Vice President Gore is a rabid free trader, supports the entry of China into the WTO, which the AFL-CIO has opposed for a very long time. And I just think that the leadership made a very, very disastrous mistake in that case, and I think many of their rank and file agree.
That's the voice of Deborah Toler, who's a specialist in political economy issues globally and an analyst this week on World Trade Watch. Up next, we talk with two family farmers. Thank you.
One of the issues high on the WTO agenda is agriculture, and farmers around the world are up in arms defending their land and their livelihood from encroachment by agricultural giants like Cargill, Monsanto, and Archer's Daniel Midland. We'll be visiting agricultural issues throughout the week. Here to kick off the discussion with us is Paul Nicholson. He's a Basque farmer with Via Campesina, an international farmers organization. Also with us is Bill Christensen. He's president of the National Family Farm Coalition. Welcome, both of you, to World Trade Watch.
Good morning. Thank you.
Good morning. Thank you.
Paul, why are agricultural issues so important to the WTO, particularly to the advocates of global trade?
Food is a weapon. Is it also a political weapon for control of the world? Through food, you control all politics, in fact. And that's why it's so important in these issues, all the question of patenting, of seeds, the whole issue of genetic food, all the issue of the model of production, sustainable agriculture, because in the end we're speaking about life, about environment, about food quality, about culture, about the diversity of culture in the world, or the maintaining of living conditions for everybody.
Farmers have been some of the most radical. One doesn't often, particularly in this country, although there's been a lot of farm revolt, think of farmers as the most radical people in any country. But around the world, farmers have really been some of the most firm voices against globalization. You've been involved in some direct actions against McDonald's, which, of course, is a very powerful symbol. Can you tell us about those?
Yes. Farmers, we are 55% of the world's population. We feed the world. We have a very important role to play. And in the north of the hemisphere, we have a smaller population, but we have a very important function. And the role and the relationship between food, farmers, and consumers is direct.
Well, tell us what you did in your direct action.
In Europe, over the last 3 months especially, over the last two years, we're very sensitive to food scandals. Food scandals, the mad cow disease, the dioxin, the use of antibiotics, of hormones, of GMOs, etc. And for us, it is a very important question because we're speaking about our health, about our countryside, and we have developed a strategy of sensibilizing people. And over this summer, there were 20 actions in France, in front of McDonald's, saying that we are against massified food. Food which has no characteristic, food which has hormones, and at the same time we're saying that each country must have the right to develop its and to protect its own food.
Well, here in the United States, we hear political leaders of both major parties talk about the need to defend, for instance, quote, family farmers. And I wonder, Christensen, as someone working so hard for the National Family Farm Coalition, how you feel about the role of the national political folks in the White House and Congress, and how you feel about their role here in Seattle at the WTO?
Well, I can tell you as a family farmer that if those people bring us WTO and freedom to farm legislation, the agriculture policy that the farmers in the U.S. are operating under, if they are our friends, we certainly don't need any enemies. Family farmers are losing the fight to stay on the land, and this is not good for the consumers of this country.
And what about the notion of, say, ecological balance, which I'm sure you deal with a lot as a farmer? Do you see parallels with other issues coming up here in Seattle around the WTO? In other words, do you have much to fear as a farmer and as a citizen from corporations in general?
Well, I can tell you right up front that we would be very much in favor of taking agriculture and the question of GMO both out of the WTO.
And by GMO, you mean?
The genetically engineered products, genetically engineered organisms, mm-hmm. precisely. If we could do that, we would be a step ahead. And the reason that would be a good position is that actually family farmers of the world are not at that table. It's the corporations that seek to exploit us.
Bill Christensen, in addition to being president of the National Family Farm Coalition, you plant soybeans in Missouri. Can you tell us, as a soybean farmer, 90% of the soybeans in this country are genetically modified. Can you tell us what you personally are up against?
My understanding is that this past year that 60% of the soybeans planted in this country were genetically engineered, and about 30% of the corn. Whenever you make that decision, and we urge farmers to not make the decision to plant GMO, but if they do plant GMO, they are going to experience greater cost and less yield, because that's the way it works.
You know, it's striking. I wanted to ask both of you about this. On the one hand, we're told that there's nothing to worry about with GMOs, et cetera, modified food. On the other hand, there's a tremendous battle that agribusiness and corporations are waging to prevent the consumer from knowing what's in their own grocery store.
That's true. And in Europe, it's very clear there is a very strong reaction against genetically modified food. It's very clear, and the farmers too. In my area, in Navarre, we used to make genetically modified maize. This year, no maize genetically modified is going to be planted by decision by the farmers. Because not only we cannot sell it anymore, because the big grocery stores or the big transformers won't buy it, but not only that, because it's not been productive, it hasn't made more production, and it is changing, it's contaminating, if you want, our own fields, our own biodiversity. And on top of that, we're losing all our autonomy to the corporations. It is absolutely unacceptable that the corporations control the seeds, controls the pesticides, and then controlling now the water. It's they're controlling the whole food chain, and that is a loss for our generation and future generations.
Bill Christensen?
There's four broad areas of concern about GMOs, and those include health problems associated, the problems for the environment, the social problems around the world, and also the economic problems. And these are very real concerns. Family farmers of the world do not want to become contract producers and be forced to buy new seeds every year. We have had access to our own seeds down through the generations for thousands of years, and that is the best way for this situation to be handled if the consumers of this country are going to have an adequate food supply.
You mentioned a moment ago that it's more costly to plant genetically modified soybeans, and I believe you yourself do not. What is the pressure on farmers? Why would they plant GMO crops if it costs them more, if there's less yield?
I think most farmers have been sold a bill of goods in the U.S. and to a lesser extent around the world through very slick advertisement, and we have this very bad freedom to farm agriculture policy in the U.S., and many farmers are losing out. They're going to lose their land. They're going to go out of business, and, you know, a drowning man will grab at a straw. Now, I could give you a very brief example. On our farm this year, the way that we acquire our seeds cost us to plant soybeans per acre $6.51. If I had planted GMO soybeans, that cost would have been $42 per acre. Now, it also takes additional weight of chemical to produce GMO than the way we farm. So, you know, those are very strong arguments that farmers should not plant GMO.
You know, I think it was long ago Francis Bacon said that we need to torture nature for its secrets. And I wonder if now at the end of the 20th century there's a corporate push to, from the vantage point of the boardroom, torture nature for her profits. I wonder, as farmers, how that strikes you.
That is very true. The process of privatization of all natural resources, of land, of water, of seeds, that is going on. Monsanto now is buying the big water reserves of the third world countries because water is going to be in the next century one of the main issues. It's also the motor of all development. and it's crucial. We need a land reform. Land reform is a new issue for the northern countries, but it is an important issue for the whole world. And in the end, the conflict is not between farmers, it's not between countries. The conflict is between corporate, intensive, industrialized farming with small-scale farmers all over the world. In Via Campesina, we are farmers from all over the world speaking the same language. I don't mind if an African farmer from Uganda speaks in my name. I know he will defend what we're saying together.
Very briefly, we just have a couple moments left. Are people, both in Europe and the United States, family farmers in danger of losing their land? And what are the consequences of corporations like Cargill, Monsanto taking over agriculture? You each got a minute.
In Europe, 200,000 farms are closed every year. 200,000 farms are closed. And the closing down of small farmers is increasing. And it's been taken over by big corporate farms. That's clear.
Bill Christensen.
We are very much concerned about the globalization and the corporatization of agriculture. In the U.S., we have less than 0.73% of our population on the land. But the startling fact is we have less than 0.13% of our population producing 83% of our food and fiber.
Paul, in the remaining 30 seconds, what are the solutions? How can farmers fight back?
Agriculture should not be WTO, and each country should have the right to develop its own agricultural policy in terms of its requirements, a policy which cannot hinder, which cannot destroy other people's policies, food policies.
Bill?
I totally agree with Paul. You know, and through our organizations around the world of love, like Via Campesina, we intend to win this battle with the corporations of the world.
We've been speaking with Paul Nicholson. He's a Basque farmer from the País Vasco. He's with Via Campesina. That's an international farmers organization. We've also been speaking with Bill Christensen. He's a soybean farmer in Missouri. He's also president of the National Family Farm Coalition. We're going to be visiting agricultural issues throughout the week. Thank you both so much for helping us kick it off on World Trade Watch.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
With Norman Solomon, I'm Julie Light. You are listening to World Trade Watch, a co-production of the National Radio Project, Corporate Watch, and the Institute for Public Accuracy. For more information about this series or for tapes or transcripts, call 1-800-529-5736. Call that same number for a free information packet or to get in touch with our guests. Again, that's 800-529-5736. You can also find us on the Internet at www.corpwatch.org or www.radioproject.org.
From Seattle, this is World Trade Watch on day two of the WTO summit. Coming up in this half hour, an in-depth report on big gaps in outlooks from rich and poor countries, plus a member of Congress calls for economic justice, and we talk with grassroots activists from Europe and India. The expansion of free trade in the last 50 years has widened the economic gap between the rich and poor countries. As a result, there has been major disagreement about how the World Trade Organization governs trade between poor countries in Africa, Asia, and Latin America, and wealthier countries in Europe and North America. This North-South debate is cutting across most issues that are up discussion at this summit in Seattle.
One of the most contentious issues on the table this week is the link between trade and workers' rights and the environment. Our special correspondent, Prothap Chatterjee, has this report from inside the World Trade Organization meetings.
The United States has recently adopted the rhetoric of some of its fiercest critics in the labor and environmental movements by calling for an examination of the negative impacts of trade. Southern countries say that the U.S. move is a cover for protectionism, continuing a decades-old fight between rich northern countries and poorer southern countries about who controls the international trading system. U.S. Trade Representative Charlene Barshefsky kicked off this latest debate by telling a gathering of trade union leaders from around the world on the day before the opening of the World Trade Organization Summit in Seattle that the WTO needs to take into account the impact of free trade on workers' rights.
Today, in a very formal sense, the WTO does not recognize that links between trade and labor exist. This is not a proposition that can endure. It is intellectually indefensible. It will, over time, weaken public support for the trading system. Our task is to ensure that the WTO recognizes that links between trade and labor policy do exist.
It's not just the United States that wants to jump on the activist bandwagon. The European Union has a very similar proposal. Pascal Lamy is the trade commissioner for the 15 countries that belong to the European Union.
The European Union proposal is to create a joint forum between the ILO and the WTO on trade, globalization, and labor issues.
The proposal to link workers' rights to trade is viewed with deep distrust, even by pro-free trade southern countries. Tufail Ahmed, the trade minister for Bangladesh, says that this is yet another example of the North imposing its policies on the South.
Without the decisions of WTO, the undeveloped countries can say that we will not export from a country like Bangladesh because of environmental problems. So definitely when we talk of the liberalization and globalization, the market is not open for the least developed countries.
The United States says that this is just another example of southern countries ignoring human rights and environmental issues. But even anti-free trade activists like Martin Kaur of Third World Network, based in Penang, Malaysia, are suspicious of the northern proposals, although for different reasons than the southern trade officials. Martin Kaur.
I don't really know to what extent the developed country governments themselves are convinced of what they are proposing or whether they are playing to the gallery, some of their public back home. The developing countries fear that if environmental and labor standards appear in the WTO, then the WTO framework will interpret these standards in a particular way that would disadvantage the developing countries. I don't think that they are arguing that labor or environment are non-issues. They are arguing that if the issue is put in the particular way they are proposed into the WTO context, then it will play itself out as blocking the products of countries with lower standards. And of course, the developing countries do have lower standards generally in some areas in respect to the environment, but not in all areas. In some areas, the northern countries have far worse environmental standards than the developing countries. But because of the power balance in the WTO, the interpretation of the developed countries is bound to win out at the end of the negotiating day. The WTO is not the place to discuss this issue. It should be discussed in the United Nations. And then if after that discussion, the role of the WTO is defined, then that role should be given to the WTO.
In fact, Darius Nahayo, the trade minister for Burundi in West Africa, says that his country has yet to benefit from joining the World Trade Organization, like many other African countries.
The impact for my country is not significantly because we have no benefit for our trade in Burundi. You see, we have all the debit on your trade. We have poverty. We have no competitiveness with our products.
Third World Network's Martin Kaur says that real change will only come if the WTO changes the way it does business. Activists from both North and South agree. Third World Network is one of over 1,000 environmental and social organizations from around the world that are calling for a review of the entire WTO regime.
We call it the three R's, you know, to review the WTO agreements, to repair them by amending those that are wrong, and to reform the system of decision-making. I'm not calling for a close down of the WTO. We do need a multilateral trade system, but the WTO is a distorted version of the system we require, and we need to pull it back on the right road so that we do build really a trade system that serves the world's people and the majority of countries. Today, it does not.
The debate between wealthy northern countries and poorer southern countries is one that is as old as the multilateral trading system itself. There are no signs that this debate will be resolved, either the labor issue or other similar issues like the environment, until some fundamental changes are made. For World Trade Watch Radio, I'm Prothap Chatterjee in Seattle.
Many years ago, as mayor of Cleveland, Ohio, Dennis Kucinich fought against efforts to privatize the city's electric company. Today, he's completing his third year as a member of the U.S. House of Representatives. We spoke with Representative Kucinich, an outspoken critic of U.S. trade policy, who is here in Seattle with the congressional delegation to the WTO. Kucinich was instrumental in setting up congressional hearings such as Chevron for human rights violations in Nigeria. He began by addressing human rights and democracy in the WTO.
If human rights become a part and parcel of what the WTO would represent, then Chevron and any other oil companies who are involved in Niger Delta could be taken to task for not only their anti-environment policies, but for violations of human rights. I mean, President Obasanjo, who is said to be working on cleaning up corruption, needs to look at the tradition which has existed in Nigeria of the corporations holding hands with the government to the detriment of people who are indigenous in the Niger Delta. It was only last week there were dozens of people killed by government troops. And we need to ask more and more questions about what's more important, oil or human life? And when the answer is oil, then we again have to ask ourselves in this country, where are our values? We need to remember our values are lost not in some great moment of furor, but our values are lost in silent ways, when we're silent, when we know people are being murdered for economic gain. The only barriers we have is our own self-doubt. And so when we are ready and prepared to make an effort, when we understand how power is organized on each side, when we understand that no matter how unassailable that power may appear to be, it's not monolithic. In a democracy, there are many different centers of power. And I think that we need to understand that if democracy fails to respond to its charge to truly be a government of the people, by the people, and for the people, then the people, as it says in the Constitution, have the right to change that government. And so action in the streets is one of the most American of all activities. And it shows you that our democracy is alive and well. We need to energize it, instill it with more fervor, and congratulate people who are out here because they care about their country and love their country and love the world and love human rights and love the rights of working men and women. And so I'd say the march goes on, and it's a march of progress.
Representative Dennis Kucinich will be joining us here in the studio tomorrow to talk about trade, labor, the environment, and other issues. Up next, grassroots activists from India and Europe. Polls show that a majority of Americans are questioning free trade policies. If this week's activities in Seattle are any indication, trade issues have catalyzed international multi-issue coalition. Despite the groundswell of public opinion against the WTO, corporations continue to rule the playing field. Joining us now to take a look behind the corporate lobbies as well as grassroots movements challenging them is Adam Mahanit of the Corporate Europe Observatory. Also joining us is Sanjay Mangala Gopal, co-coordinator of the National Alliance of People's Movements in India. Thank you both so much for coming in and joining us.
Thank you.
And this is a day of protests throughout the streets of Seattle. We have a report that one of our correspondents in the field is near the convention center, has been hit in the back of the head with a baton. She's okay, but they are tear gassing. Sanjay, you came straight here from a protest where you spoke. You crossed the United States in a caravan with People's Global Action. Can you tell us what the mood in the streets is?
Excellent. All the streets today are being captured by the people from all around the world, and it is really amazing. And the kind of nonviolent direct action that people are doing, it is great, and it's really the people's power that is on the streets of Seattle today.
Before we talk a little bit about people's movements in India, can you tell us a little bit about the caravan that went from the East Coast of the United States here to Seattle with People's Global Action?
Yeah, this is we started on October 28th from New York, and through 20 cities all over, we had teach-ins and conferences and demonstrations, and we received a great response from the audience, from the U.S. citizens, and it was really great to know that U.S. citizens, like in India, we always talk, whenever we talk about globalization, we towards U.S. But now I have a chance to go back and tell my people that many, many U.S. citizens are with us. That's what we found.
You know, that really is striking about different versions or concepts of what globalization means. And I wanted to ask Adam Mahanit, from your perspective as an activist based mostly in Europe, what's the significance of the events here in Seattle this week?
Well, I think a lot of people in Europe are really looking towards Seattle for some sign that change is going to happen. Because as you may have heard, that there was a lot of mass protests going on in Europe during the G8 summit back in June, during EU summits for many years now. And there's a long tradition in Europe of people taking to the streets and demanding their rights. And so now the focus is on Seattle. And I think a lot of people back home in Europe are really looking to Seattle.
And so in a sense, there's some kind of a global mutual inspiration going on? Is that part of the process?
I think so. There's also a lot of people have actually come here just to participate in the demonstrations on the street, and also to take part in any activities around here, and also to bring the word back home, back in Europe, where people can learn more about what's going on here in the United States.
Sanjay, you're with the National Alliance of People's Movements in India. India has some of the most vibrant anti-globalization movements in the world, which we in the United States hear almost nothing about. Can you tell us what are the issues that the communities you work with confront? What are the tactics they use to confront them?
In fact, this National Alliance of People's Movements in India is an alliance of more than 100 movements and organizations which are working with fisher folks, farmers, tribals, women, all sections of the society. We have many battles going on. In fact, every corner in every city in India, we have battles going on against globalization. To name a few of them, we had a very big battle going on against a transnational corporation, US-based Enron, which is coming to India for producing power. And in fact, it is making powerless to the people of India. They are grabbing our land, and people are fighting. In Kerala and Tamil Nadu, people have not let Enron come in to even make a survey of the land. They are determined not to make Enron to come and grab their land and natural resources. Another big battle we are having right now in the Valley of Narmada. Narmada is one of the biggest rivers in India, and people are fighting against a big dam which has come under the pressure of World Bank and IMF, which is also connected with WTO. And people are fighting that they say that this type of big dam, which is going to displace millions of tribals and farmers from their farms and houses, they don't want this. There is alternative possible for the watershed management. So people are fighting, and in the recent monsoon rainy season, thousands of activists, tribals and farmers and activists stood in the water. Our slogan was "Dubenge par hatenge nahi." We will get drowned, but we will not move out of our farms and huts. And we stood in water for 15 hours up to neck level, but we did not move till police came and arrested us. So it's a tremendous resistance is going on. Fisher folks are fighting against multinational trawlers which are coming to grab the fishing around of India. So everywhere the battle is going on, and people are on the streets every day because it's a matter of our survival. We have to fight.
What is it that makes people in India willing to stand in water up to their necks, willing to stand up to a corporation like Houston-based Enron, one of the largest and most powerful in the world, and not even let them survey the land? I think we have told that globalization is inevitable. We're told that we can't fight back against this corporation, yet you have grassroots farmers and local communities in India one of the poorest countries in the world, standing up to some of the most powerful corporations.
Maybe because we had this experience of colonization for about 150 years. So this process of globalization is India, in fact, when Britishers came and started looting our natural resources. So we know what it is going to make with us. And therefore, people are well aware that what this globalization means, what this free trade means. Free trade is no freedom to the people. It's a freedom for the transnational corporation to grab their land, grab their natural resources. And if tribals don't have land and forest, if farmers do not have land, if fisher folks do not have access to the fishing, where they will go? So it's for the survival. Either they will get beaten up and die because of the transnational corporation, or they will die while striking on the road, striking against them. So they have chosen to fight till the end. And the type of alliance that we have built, like if farmers are fighting, tribals are supporting, if tribals are fighting, fisher folks are supporting, this type of solidarity has been built up in India in the last 5 years. Like today when I'm here, all over India, like it's already 30th November is over in India, there are tremendous demonstrations going on. People are just don't want WTO.
And meanwhile, in Europe, what kind of coalitions are being galvanized to deal with the sort of issues that are on the agenda here at the WTO summit?
Well, a lot of people have come around the banner of the anti-GMO movement in Europe. That's been one of the strongest points where people have sort of found an interface with the WTO, because they've seen people in Europe don't want biotechnologies to be imported into their countries. They don't want the fields growing genetically engineered crops. And so a lot of people have taken to the fields, have removed the crops, have demanded that the supermarkets don't stock these on the shelves, and demanded from their governments that they don't import or allow imports of these products into their countries, or at least label them. And we've seen a lot of resistance from that, from corporations who are trying to sell and gain market access in the European Union. And so a lot of people there have seen that this is what the WTO is facilitating to happen.
And what kind of laws are there about labeling of genetically modified food
at the
products?
At the moment, the European country has a different labeling law and regime. Within the European Union, however, because of the centralization of decision-making between the different European nations, we're seeing that there's a trend towards not all labeling to happen, because the decision-makers fear that this is going to come up in a challenge in the WTO.
We're speaking with Adam Mahanit. He's with the Corporate Europe Observatory, that's CEO. And also joining us is Sanjay Mangala Gopal, sometimes called Sanjay MG. He's co-coordinator of the National Alliance of People's Movements in India. You're listening to World Trade Watch. We hear a lot, Adam, about the behind-the-scenes lobbying at the WTO, about the corporations setting the agenda, and that seems somewhat Machiavellian, it seems somewhat conspiratorial, but there really are institutions and mechanisms for how this works. The Corporate Europe Observatory has been following this. Can you tell us a little about some of them?
Yes, well, we've found for a long time that people have assumed that transnational corporations have had a tremendous role to play within the World Trade Organization, but it wasn't very clear how. And what we've found is that there is, in fact, a very official interface between big business and governments. And within the European Union and the United States, they've set up this process called the Transatlantic Business Dialogue, where governments sit down together with the top CEOs from the largest transnational corporations of their region. So in the U.S., it would be people like Bill Gates, Boeing, Phil Condit, other people like that. They sit down together in a room, and these CEOs tell Charlene Bartsky what they want, what they want to get rid of when they're trading the European Union, which is the largest trading partner for the U.S. And they have a whole list of recommendations that they want them to work on. These CEOs then get together in these annual meetings and present their recommendations to the government officials. So Charlene Barshefsky and Pascal Amin, European, receive these recommendations. And then 6 months later on, the industry officials, the CEOs, rate government on how far they've implemented their decisions, their recommendations. So they give them a scorecard. They actually call it a scorecard, and they rate both the EU and U.S. governments on how rapidly they've been implementing big business desires. And this is an official process. Now, we don't see the same thing happening within, for example, the environmental lobby or in other social lobbies, where a lot of organizations are trying to influence policy to promote environmental standards, labor standards, et cetera. And we don't have these similar high-level interfaces between government officials and NGO representatives.
So it sounds almost as though, or it sounds as though, corporations are regulating government rather than the other way around.
Exactly.
And is that true in India as well?
Right. That is what is happening in India. In fact, when I was listening to Adam, I thought he's describing what is happening in India. It's exactly similar pattern. They want to control the politicians, the decision-making power, and that not only that, in India, they have managed to, the intellectuals and press media, they are getting written by these people in India, how this transnational corporation is doing good and this and that. So they are in fact trying to, and through advertised media, they are trying to got our culture also in India. They are creating new culture and inculcating things through advertisement on the TV. So all walks of life, they have to take the grab. That is what is happening.
Sanjay, tell us about a specific activist, a specific community. So much of what you describe sounds like such a rich tradition of activism. Help put a human face on us. Give us an anecdote of some specific people that you know who are colleagues and friends of yours who've stood up to corporate globalization.
Yeah, there are many, many, many people who I know are fighting, and it's not individual that they're fighting. They're fighting with the people, making organizations and doing that. Like I can give an example in the fisher folk communities. The fisher folks are having access to the fishing thing, and that is their livelihood. When they found that the multinational corporations are coming to the coast for the with their trawlers to fish, and the amount of fishing these trawlers were doing, they're uprooting fisher folks. So the fisher folks stood so unitedly against this battle. And I know many people who, without bothering their house, without their bothering their families, they dared to get court arrested. They went for the strikes for more than 10 days, 15 days against these corporations. And they could get some of the laws being changed and some of their demands met by step. So that sort of victory signs makes moral more strong and unite strongly. So this is what is happening there.
You know, I'm curious, and personally, I was in India 40 years ago and was struck by how recent the proximity was to colonialism, to British rule. And for both of you, I'm wondering what relationship this current corporate power and dominance around the planet has to colonialism.
I can tell you one thing. I always tell when I was listening how British used to rule, Britishers were required to come to India and rule us. Now these corporates are ruling with remote control sitting here. They don't need to come there. And that is how they have hypnotized everybody and pressurized everybody under this WTO, IMF, World Bank regime. Under the name of giving aid to us, they impose the structural adjustment programs on us, which are just conditions which make us slaves. And this new type of slavery is coming, which is different than what we experienced earlier. But it is more attacking, creating more havoc on us.
And from the vantage point of Europe?
I think it's important also to remember, following on what Sanjay said, that one of the first steps in colonialism of India and in African countries was the British East India Company, and that they actually needed a transnational corporation to begin a trading relationship of colonization of these countries and import and export of goods. So already from the beginning of the colonization process, you already saw the beginnings of the development of what we have now is called the multilateral trading system under the WTO.
We're speaking with Adam Mahanit of the Corporate Europe Observatory. Also in the studio with us is Sanjay Mangala Gopal, co-coordinator of the National Alliance of People's Movements in India. And both of you started off saying, we're here in the United States. The United States is often seen as the seat of corporate power in the world, and there have been movements in India and Europe for years against globalization, and suddenly we're seeing that people in the United States have woken up. Can you talk a little bit about what it is like to be an international visitor, internationalist in this country and see what's going on in the streets of Seattle today, Sanjay?
It's really great to see that the people in U.S. are getting awakened. And it's not only that they are doing something justified to the South, they are doing helping us. They have realized what I found during caravan, that they have realized they are also next in the queue for the attack of globalization. So this is great. And another thing what they are realizing, I found that the consumerism of U.S. and American wealthiest people, that is creating havoc on in the third world countries, because transnational corporations are coming, producing dirty things in our part to fulfill the needs, unwanted greeds of the Europeans and US people. They are realizing this. The bicycle movement, reduced consumerism, I found many places. It's amazing. Like going towards the alternative energy resources, which are eco-friendly. This type of awareness is increasing in US. This is very good. Another thing I found, that this globalization struggle, they're really understanding that South is going to lead this struggle and we are going to support. It is not another type of movement which will be dominated by North. So that is good. That is good solidarity, real solidarity.
I think it's really inspiring to see what's happening here. Maybe a few months ago, very few Americans would have known what the WTO was, and now all of a sudden it's become a household name. So I think that in itself is a real step in the right direction in terms of raising public awareness about these important issues. Also, I think one of the most inspiring things as well is the amount of diversity that you see in the protests here in the streets in Seattle. You have women's groups, labor groups, environmental groups, people from the direct action movements, grassroots, local communities, farmers, people of color. All these people have gathered together and protest against the WTO because they've seen that they have shared agenda, they have shared concerns about the way that the world is going. And lastly, I think one of the most inspiring things that's happening here is one of the largest visuals of labor organizing in the United States. It's so many years now that you haven't heard a peep about any kind of mass labor movement taking place in the United States. And now finally you see all these union members, teachers getting together, organizing, hitting the streets, and it's like the 60s all over again.
Sanjay, do you think that this burgeoning and emerging international coalition will hold together? Many people say so much energy went into preparing for Seattle, but it's so critical what happens after Seattle.
Yes, I consider this this is the beginning that is taking place in Seattle. Like whatever may happen in WTO conference, the solidarity which has come together in Seattle, people from all over the world here and joining hands with the hands, this solidarity will continue. And understanding between problems of South and North of the globalization and fight for justice and peace, this real global moment will come. This is the beginning.
We've been speaking with Sanjay Mangala Gopal, co-coordinator of the National Alliance of People's Movements in India, also with Adam Mahanit of the Corporate Europe Observatory. Thank you both so much for taking time out of the protests in the street to join us here on World Trade Watch.
Thank you very much.
That wraps it up for this edition of World Trade Watch. Special thanks to KUOW and our engineer, Doug Patterson. Our producer is Philip Babbage. Executive producers, Peggy Law and Josh Carliner. Associate producer, Stephanie Welch. World Trade Watch is a co-production of the National Radio Project, Corporate Watch, and the Institute for Public Accuracy. For more information on this series or a tape or transcript, call 1-800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. You can also find us on the web at www.radioproject.org or www.corpwatch.org. With Norman Solomon, I'm Julie Light. Thanks for listening.